Hi, hello. We have a jam-packed episode of The Dunker Spot coming your way. First, we've got more trades to talk about. Ja Morant heading to the Portland Trail Blazers. The Charlotte Hornets making some moves to add some shooting to the room. We've got NBA free agency rumors on the cusp of the week. We have a lot to talk about on the NBA side. On the W side, we look at the middle of the standings. We have a lot of good teams. We have some question marks to suss through. And we have the Commissioner's Cup Championship game between the Aces and the Liberty happening a little bit later. We previewed that one. We had a lot of fun on this episode. We hope you enjoy. Hi, hello, and welcome to another episode of The Dunker Spot. We are part of the Yahoo Sports Network. I am your host, Nikias Duncan. And joining me, as always, is my co-host, the always excellent Steve Jones Jr. Steve, happy Tuesday. We're back. How are you, sir?
Feeling good, feeling great. Happy to be here. Excited to be here. Thank you, Dunkers, for once again embracing your bounce. I'm ready to talk more trades. I'm ready to talk more hoops. Shout out to you, Nikias. Big bag. Boy, never home.
let's not do that. I am currently undisclosed location in New York, in town for the Commissioner's Cup Championship game. We'll be talking about that more on the W side. But as Steve alluded to, we do have more transactions. As I guess we're recording on a Tuesday morning, so it's not really free agency eve as things officially kick off at 6 p.m. Eastern later today. But boy, are we getting some movement, and boy, have we had some moves. And coming through the pipeline on Monday was Ja Morant being traded away from the Memphis Grizzlies. Not a surprise that Ja Morant was traded from Memphis. I feel like the writing's been on the wall for quite some time. Not a surprise that the Portland Trail Blazers made a splash because they have been linked to Giannis before you eventually went to Miami. There have been talks with the Boston Celtics about Jaylen Brown. And if you zoom out with their roster, they do just have lots of young talent, lots of veteran and mid-sized contracts. They have a lot of picks. They could easily get into a conversation for things. I am surprised that Ja ends up being the Blazers swing. And so I'm still trying to like process that one in real time. So Steve, to start with you, how did you feel about this deal being made? And what are some of your initial impressions about this deal?
I was driving, so I didn't know what to do. It was odd to feel that. I think as you let it sink in, it's a weird feeling. And for me, like it's not the instant variety I'm trying to process. Mm-hmm. Specifically knowing what the Grizzlies mean to Memphis and knowing what the Blazers mean to Portland and seeing Memphis ship off their former all-star and Portland take a swing to get an all-star, it's going to take some time to sink in. Like, think about the fact that the Blazers had the season they had last year, exceeded expectations, and now add Damian Lillard and Ja Morant. That sentence is going to take some time to soak in, right? Mm-hmm. It's a talent swing for Portland, and I understand it. If the cost to add Ja Morant to your team involves zero picks, I understand taking the swing and seeing what happens. Jeremy Grant, Chris Murray helped Blazers, no doubt. You trust the wings you have, though. You build from there, and you turn them into Ja Morant. Let's do it. Now, Nikias, we're recording early on a Tuesday, as you like to say. Let's introduce our guest, and that's the elephant in the room. Say hi. There's a couple ways to evaluate this trade. We'll do our best to give you a blend. Mm-hmm. Is this the first trade before the next trade? Doesn't sound like it. I don't know if the words Jaylen Brown are going to be uttered, but apparently it has to be uttered if you're a team in free agency with potential ability to trade. Like, you just have to say the words Jaylen Brown, like the boogeyman or something. I don't know if that's going to be it. Can't tell the future. But I do kind of want to talk about this as if Ja Morant is the swing for Portland. It feels like a long shot for some folks, Nikias. It feels like Ja Morant has been written off to a degree where it's like, well, are we sure he's that type of player at this moment? And he got traded. Like, not only do people kind of write him off into a specific spot, I feel like, he also got traded to a team that has a lot of guards. And so if last year's Blazers wing room was crowded, this guard room would be pretty crowded. That's Scoot Henderson. That's Jrue Holiday. That's Ja Morant. That's Damian Lillard. That's Shaedon Sharpe. Jrue's versatility in theory should help if you're thinking combinations that can be stat. Tumani Kamara can play a whole lot of different positions, guard different people. Three-guard lineups are fun. I think the main thing for me, this is a fresh start for Ja Morant. And whatever clouds lingered over him in Memphis will now be replaced with the good old-fashioned, traditional, lovely, dark gray rain clouds of Portland. Which Ja Morant will the Portland Trailblazers get? He's dynamic. Mm-hmm. He can still get downhill. He's a walking paint touch. His drives are going to be important for this team. And so we kind of have the balance of, okay, what's the fit look like? How's he fit into this team? He played 20 games last year. He was still at 15.7 drives per game last year. That was sixth in the NBA, Nikias. And he joins a Blazers team who last year led the NBA in drives per game at 59.6. I think that could boost a play style or identity they could build on. Now, we have a walking theme here. This is a different team in the sense that they have a new coach. So that looms large as far as how they want to build this out. But this is a team that likes to drive the basketball. He helps them there. How much does Ja Morant help the Blazers in pick and roll? Do they get the benefit of having multiple ball handlers who can operate? I, while the soccer tournament was going on, Nikias, decided to scrum through some Memphis Grizzlies film from last year to see, hey, sicko behavior for this. How many minutes did Ja Morant and Cam Spencer play together?
Okay.
Not that this is apples, but I'm like, all right, let's see if there's some overlap. It's like, okay, so let's run double drag for Ja Morant. If that's Damian Lillard's space on the weak side, that's a positive thing for Portland. You can use Drew Holiday as a screener. Like, you can make things happen to make this work. Ja Morant and pick and roll should help Donovan Clingan. He can get downhill. The interesting part is going to be the dynamic as far as Ja has shown a desire to try to work on the in-between game. We saw that last year. I don't think a lot of people liked the results, but the attempt was important. He saw a drop. He tried to get to the mid-range, try and add some floaters. In the Memphis context last year, it was loud because if you're missing and we're trying to do a specific thing and you're kind of doing something different, it feels off. And also the thing about the Memphis context last year, I think people forget about, teams were just determined to make Ja Morant uncomfortable. Like, oh, you're not having a good time. Well, how about we throw some traps at you, big dog, while you're not really ready for it? Or let's put two on the ball. Let's get to level. Let's try and take away your ability to turn the corner just so you're not having a good time. Can he achieve those things in Portland? Does that boost the Blazers? So I'll start there.
I would just like to say, one, I appreciate the start, and I appreciate the blend that you've already attempted to establish. Two, you bringing up Cam Spencer in this segment before I could is not something that I had on the bingo card, and I could not be more proud to be doing this podcast with you. So I appreciate you for the Cam Spencer show. In all seriousness.
That's where the pride comes from?
No, I'm playing it up for effect. But I would just say, on a more serious note, I am fascinated by Ja within this offensive context. I think if you watched the Blazers last year, and specifically watched them after the turn of the calendar, where they were just firmly a top 10 defense, they got out in transition a lot. As you already mentioned, they like to drive the basketball a lot. The efficiency in transition and the efficiency when they got downhill outside of Denny Avdija getting to the free throw line, which felt like every other trip, wasn't always great. And so when you add a Ja Morant into this, he should boost the transition attack, assuming that the defense is still at a certain level. And Buddy, depending on what lineups he's on the floor with, he should be pretty insulated. And this is independent of just asking for more consistent effort and attention to detail from Ja Morant defensively. That's just going to be a thing. But they should have lineups that defense is still strong. Ja should help them get out in transition or flow into some early offense stuff. And his ability to still get downhill, maybe not at peak all-star levels, but get downhill and operating in the middle of the floor should help. The other thing I would note with this Portland offense, and I think this is where like having Dame back is going to help as well, is that as much as Portland got downhill and the way that they were, you know, reconfigure their spacing, have Donovan Clingan on the wing, let him make some playmaking decisions, etc. Overall, this wasn't like a great passing team. You had guys that could beat tilted defenses, and again, using Clingan as a hub was a way to kind of invert the offense and make things easier. But like even with Denny Avdija racking up a bunch of assists, it was a lot of, I get downhill so often, I draw attention, I can make basic reads from there. There wasn't a ton of manipulation. Drew Holiday can get you into your offense, but like he's not peak manipulator in pick and roll. He's better at attacking tilted defenses. Ja Morant as a guy, even this version of him, is a guy that can manipulate defenses at a level that nobody else on the roster, sans maybe Dame in some stretches, can really do consistently. And I wonder what that's going to do for the half-court offense. I am intrigued, as you were, funny enough, you were getting looking at some of the Cam Spencer things with Ja Morant. I was trying to remember, like, how often did him and Zach Edey play together? Because I was trying to figure out, like, what is that pick and roll combination going to look like with him and Donovan Clingan? Because for as much as I'm intrigued with Clingan, particularly defensively, he is a very good screener. The roles need some work. We'll put it that way out of the interest of time. And so I'm just kind of wondering, like, what is the pacing going to look like in combination with what you already mentioned with Ja, him operating in the middle of the floor, trying to get into more floaters, trying to get into more pull-ups and whatnot. I do think him plus Klingon should be a partnership in pick and roll or in handoffs, in where it's going to be slower paced. But I think Ja's a good enough ball handler and still has the short burst stuff to get all the way to the rim, to where I think Klingon will carve out space for him. It should unlock some shots inside the arc for Ja and unlock some passing reads that should lead to some better quality shot quality for the guys that are spaced on the perimeter. So, like, that is something that I am intrigued by. I do have an overall, like, shooting question based on what the lineups are. I think for Mike Anori, finding the balance of we have enough defense for Ja plus Dame or just Ja, while also having the shooting necessary to make sure that those guys can thrive inside the arc, that is going to be a tightrope that he's going to have to walk. But there are absolutely pathways to where Ja, the basketball player, just helps this offense. It makes life a lot easier for everyone.
Okay, bookmark the shooting one. Let's get back to that one. Let's roll back to the pick and roll point that you made. I wonder if this version of Ja, who is a little bit more bursty than flat out turbo button, helps Donovan Klingon in pick and roll as far as being able to set up, get to his pocket. He's very tall, so that should attract help. Ja's pretty good, or has gotten better as far as I get deep in the paint, I can make an interior pass. Are they better equipped to play together now than maybe at different points in their careers? So that's one thing
that's when
you said that lit off in my brain. The second part you said, I believe, you talked about the creation, manipulation, the assist. That was part of the swing for Portland for me. And I think if you think about it, we saw Minnesota take a swing to enhance their backcourt, right? We saw this season how the consistent guard player from the Spurs was able to help them find a level of consistency throughout a ball game. We also saw what the Spurs did to the Blazers in the playoffs. In the playoff series, the Blazers had 21.4 assists per game. Seven of those came from Jrue Holiday. So, hey, I can understand wanting to have more playmaking in the building. I can understand wanting to be able to add more drives, being able to add more threats in the building. Is this the overall cleanest puzzle fit to your shooting point? I don't know if I would go there right now. But if they were to keep everyone, they're always going to have good guard play. And so my mind kind of goes to, like, you know, I think what Scoot averaged 25 minutes a game in the regular season last year. Playoffs had a lot of Scoot and Jrue together. They split and always had one. How does this overall help everyone involved? Like, I think there's a concern probably if you're a Blazer fan. Hey, we just unlocked Scoot. We're trying to make sure we get all of Shaden. Is this going to get in the way of everyone? I don't know if that's a guarantee to a degree, right? Does this just allow Damian Lillard to come back and have an impact while also not having to play a massive minute load or carry a massive playmaking load? Is that important or valuable? Does this allow Ja to be able to come in and play hard and play fast and play with the energy and burst that we know without having to carry a ton of minutes or the bulk of the workload? Does this give a clear path to Scoot Henderson and Shaedon Sharpe as far as, hey, this is what we need from you. Go do that.
Yeah.
And then does this enhance the overall glue, band-aid, I'm going to do everything you need and more of Jrue Holiday? Can they build this in a way that where we can get the most out of these guys together? How much of this is a trust in Jrue and Dame and Scoot's ability to make plays off ball to a degree? How much of this is we're just going to have people who can do things on any side of the floor. And so I think a lot of Scoot's growth was, hey, someone has now done something and got me the ball. I'm going to work. He improved. Pace was better. Rhythm was better. But, hey, kick me the ball. I'm getting to my spot. I'm being decisive. We're gone.
Out of here.
Shaedon Sharpe, he's at his best. Decisive, I'm gone. So is this just finding a way to try and enhance everyone in a non-traditional fashion?
No, I think that is fair. And I think seeds of the Spurs with this their continuous guard play, what we've seen for OKC, where they just have the ways of guys that can attack tilted defenses, can bend your defense, can screen for each other, etc. We saw with the Indiana Pacers during their finals run, like, it's Tyrese Haliburton, but he's getting off the ball. We have a lot of different guys that can attack. I think in general, the league seems to be shifting more towards not necessarily you have to have three or four good guards, but just an overall comfort within your lineups that everyone can make a decision. Everyone can attack. And so Portland shifting more in that direction, it is something that makes sense conceptually to me. I do think, again, they are going to have to find the right blend of talent and the right blend of lineups to make sure that that is maximized. But the concept itself isn't offensive to me. And I think if Ja's in a situation, to your point, where I can get downhill. I can make plays. I do not have to carry this offense because I have Dame to my side, or I have Denny Avdia that can, you know, absorb a bunch of usage, or Denny's like, well, cool, I can still get to my drives, et cetera. I don't have to carry this offense because I have Ja, I have Dame, et cetera. It should make life easier for everyone on that front.
We can talk about the emphasis on drives and how they could all play together. One, does Ja have the same burst? Is he going to be able to force the same level of help that we saw in that OKC playoff series? Two, to your shooting point, is Portland going to be able to find enough lineups that are good on both ends, but also lineups where the defense is not just planted in the paint, waiting on whoever has the ball to drive into the paint? Mm-hmm. That is the one thing where I'm like, I am very curious. I like that you have the ability to put this kind of pressure on teams. Are you ready to adjust and respond once they say, hey, we would like you to not enter the paint? So I want to stick it there, and then you can take us wherever you'd like to go.
Okay. No, I think that part is fair. And this is where, like, we talked about this on the pod a little bit last year, and I know I tweeted about it as well. To Monte Kamara just kind of randomly becoming like high volume, solid 3-point shooter just felt like one of the most underrated developments in the league last year. And so if that holds, like, do I expect him to start getting like Steph level closeouts next year? Like, I don't. But that does help if you're looking at some of the lineup combination they can tap into. If Tumani's just going to be like your starting four this year, like, okay, those corner shots may feel a little bit different if he's spaced there. And teams know, like, not only is he knocking these down, he's willing to take more of them over the last year and a half or so. So, like, that's going to be important. Obviously, Dame can knock down shots. We'll see how often him and Ja play together. Drew has had, like, a pretty up-and-down catch-and-shoot history. I just want to say quickly, broad scale, because you look at this trade for Ja Morant, and no picks are involved. The Grizzlies send $1 million in cash considerations in this deal to get Ja to Portland. And so, like, you don't get there without the decline in stature and the injuries and all the off-court stuff, et cetera. I will just say, seeing some of the commentary and reading some of the commentary with Ja heading to Portland, I am a little uncomfortable with how far this has gone in some spaces with how Ja is being talked about. I think the onus is on him to prove that there will not be any off-ball, off-court things popping up in Portland, et cetera. I would like to just see a general chance given for him to, like, do that. And so this is kind of the quote-unquote low point for him. He's gone from all-star to I am being traded for Jeremy Grant plus Chris Murray, no picks at all. And I'm just like, hey, I'm curious. I want to see him in this new spot. I want to see him thrive in it. So obviously the onus is on him to not have anything pop up off the court while in Portland. But, like, I would like to see the chance generally given to him to do that before immediately writing him off and seeing some of the things that I've seen so far. So I just want to see him thrive in this new spot. I want to see him recapture the all-star form. I want to see Ja back in a higher light. So I'm excited to see what this looks like in Portland. There are pathways for this to work. That is just what I want to sprinkle in. Like, I've seen some things. It's like, hey, let's not. I understand the concerns, but let's not do all of that. That's it.
It's very funny. Nikai said, I've seen some things when I've seen some things, and everyone's bringing the World Jailblazers back. And I was a kid who loved that team. So now you've triggered me, and we got to sit here for a second. So let's sit here. Don't do that. Don't do the Jailblazer thing. Let Ja Morant have a fresh start. I'm not defending nobody, but let's not do that automatically. Let's see what happens on the court. Let's let him embrace this opportunity. Let's let him inspire an entire generation of Oregon high school kids. Mm-hmm. Let's see what happens. That's an Easter egg, by the way. Some of y'all can make these jokes. Some of y'all can talk about Lake House where you go. Some of y'all can't. So let's just tread lightly to a degree. All right. Let's see what happens. Back to the basketball, right?
Mm-hmm.
I find it interesting because I feel like people are discussing this trade like Portland sent all the guards for Ja. And he's in the room with them. And so it's an odd balancing act. Like, if they had paid high price and traded a guard for Ja, people would feel differently about this trade. But because they still have all the guards, people feel a type of way about this trade. And I find that intriguing. The big mystery to me, what are these Blazers going to run? It's a new fit with the coach. How does that help Ja as far as, hey, can I just be me? How important is that to a degree? How much value does that have? I think it's going to be interesting. As a coach, you are going to need some clean philosophy, some clean principles. You're going to have to get buy-in. You have to attack from there. Everyone's going to have to know exactly what the assignment is, what the mission is, and you got to get that from the jump. I will say to the some of the fit questions, some are fair, some I won't poke at. You do have Damian Lillard not only fresh off an injury, but returning back to Portland. I think he's going to be intrigued in making sure the vibes stay high and going to be happy to play basketball. You have Ja Morant finally no longer having to emote at his own bench mid-game. Fresh start, fresh situation. I think you have an ability to max out the, okay, let's get to work vibes-wise. And so fit's going to be key. Fit's going to be interesting. It's going to develop. I still don't feel like you can like combine everything right now to try and pivot and make a trade. Like, whatever question marks you have about this team, if they take the two or three guards they have left and turn that into a wing, are you going to feel that much better? I don't know if you're going to feel that way. I think you have the flexibility down the road to make a move if you need to and someone comes available, which is probably more important for Portland. And for me, I think if you're top of the Portland organization, so it's like, hey, if I'm paying this amount of money to Jeremy Grant, can I get an all-star, please? Thank you.
So I think I was just going to say the end of the Jeremy Grant and he's good, but this contract, oh my goodness, that turning into Ja Morant. I think you should take that. Like, again, there are reasons that Ja was available and that's fair. But if that's the talent play, I think you probably take that if you're Portland. I guess in a literal sense, they did take that since Ja Morant is a member of the Portland Trailblazers. So that it's interesting that that's how that ended. Actually, did you have Grizzlies thoughts?
I mean, I have a few. One, the last thing on Ja, defensively, that's where the territory is going to have to be hit. They are going to have to nail that. Teams are going to look to put him in action. We know that. He's going to have to level up to do your job territory. He's been a part of good defenses. So we'll see if the bones are going to be as good for Portland with different lineups. They'll have rim protection. So, okay, got to nail the off-ball actions. Got to nail your show and recover and your switch. You just have to do your job. So it'll be interesting to see how Portland builds that out defensively. To the Memphis portion of the program, whole Grizzly core is gone again. Desmond Bane, Jaren Jackson Jr., Ja Morant, all gone. Another chapter for Memphis has once again coming on and closed quicker than anyone would have thought. I did a thought exercise at 4:12 this morning, and I just wrote these names down. Are you ready?
Yes.
Just bear with me. It'll make sense at the end. Tayshaun Prince, Ed Davis, Austin Day, Jonas Valanciunas, CJ Miles, DeLon Wright, Grayson Allen, Jay Crowder, Kyle Korver. Those were the returns for Rudy Gay, Mark Gasol, and Mike Conley. And on the other side, we have Kentavious Caldwell-Pope, Cole Anthony, Kyle Anderson, Walter Clayton Jr., Taylor Hendricks, George Niang, Jeremy Grant, Chris Murray. That is a return for Desmond Bane, Jaren Jackson Jr., and Ja Morant.
Wow. That is
so I got.
That's wild how that ends. Also not the best time to be Ed Davis right now, I would say. But okay, to my Grizzlies thoughts. I am fascinated by both of these fits right now. Gotta say, on the Jeremy Grant front, as the big salary guy coming back to Memphis, having a wing / four that can knock down shots and that can self-create a little bit should help grease the wheels of the half-court offense a little bit without him having to carry that, because that is not a fair expectation of him. If he can work within what Memphis wants to do holistically, I think he should be able to fit there. He should provide some short-term value for there. Chris Murray, I'm curious to see like where the shot ultimately lands for him. I do find it fascinating, I guess both for Grant and Murray, that as Steve, we spent a bunch of time, and I specifically spent a bunch of time talking about the rise of full-court pressure and how cool it is, and we talked about Portland and their full-court press and everything else. The Memphis Grizzlies did that more than anyone in the league last year. It's like them, Brooklyn, Portland, like we are going to press you. We're not going to have a good time. So it is funny to me that these two teams made these trades, made this specific trade where Jeremy Grant was a part of the full court pressure package. Chris Murray was absolutely a part of the full court pressure package. And now you are sliding them both into Memphis that was doing that stuff already. So like there's some synergy already there in terms of how they want to defend. You're adding more length and versatility to the room, at least in theory. Jeremy Grant gives you some short-term scoring punch. We will see. I'm curious to see, like, from a lineup perspective, how often we see him at the three versus at the four. And that also just kind of ties into Zach Edey coming back. You obviously add Cam Boozer. We'll have some more Memphis thoughts a little bit later. But this is where I'm intrigued to see, like, what the starting lineup is going to be. Because if we do get Ty Jerome, Cedric Cowart, Jeremy Grant, Cam Boozer, and Zach Edey, that is a lot of size to kind of insulate Ty Jerome. but that is in theory a lot of switchability, 2 through 4. Like, you could really build out some things and get into some real mismatch hunting with this group offensively. Like, I tweeted it out yesterday. I'm kind of buying stock in this Grizzlies group if they are any semblance of healthy, because Lord knows they were not last season. There are just a lot of good basketball players in the room and a lot of collective size in this group that I'm becoming more and more intrigued by. So, like, I would just sprinkle that in. We obviously have an entire offseason to go, so we'll have some deeper – thoughts when we get to season previews and things a few months from now. But I'm just like, hey man, there's some creation, there's some size, there's some skill. The defense is going to be active. Like, it's an interesting group being built in.
You have size, depth, versatility, wings, bigs, and you can fully lean into the next era of Memphis Grizzlies basketball. I understand it. Now, you can't trick me. You've taken your Brooklyn Nets stock because they added Julius Randle and converted it into Memphis Grizzlies stock. You can't trick me. I'm not dealing with that pump fake. We're good to go. Because I got the summer hipster playlist right here. Y'all gonna start with the Grizzlies. Track 2 is the Hornets. You're going to mix in some Bulls. You're going to mix in some Nets somehow. And then right around summer league, they start playing. You're going to get some Jazz going. And then by fall, you're going to try and throw back and put the Pacers out there. I know what y'all up to. So it'll be interesting to see it.
Good call.
Funny to kind of see the dynamic and response last week to the Hornets trading LaMelo Ball and the reaction to the Grizzlies trading Ja Morant. And how people felt about the Hornets before they made another trade, and how people feel about the Grizzlies right away. I am clocking it. Just want y'all to know. I'll see y'all later down the road, but real dynamic reactions that people had between those two teams, those two trades.
That's very well done. Actually, let's segue there, as we did to get another trade between the Hornets and the Phoenix Suns. Grayson Allen, Royce O'Neal, and a 2033 unprotected first-round pick going to the Charlotte Hornets. The Suns receiving Miles Bridges, a 29 first-round pick that is top five protected, also the least favorable of Cleveland, Minnesota, and Utah, and a 2027 second-round pick that's the least favorable of Boston and Orlando. So, Steve, how do you feel about the Hornets following up the LaMelo Ball trade with adding Grayson Allen and Royce O'Neal into the room?
I think for the Hornets, they're going the depth and versatility route. And so there's a lot of talk about, oh, well, how do you do this? And Kobe White's the point guard. But they started Sion James and Colin Sexton at point guard at times. Like, they're going to double down on working to pressure, keep pressure on teams, keep pressure on defenses as a team. And so while you might not have that true two-on-the-ball type playmaker, we're going to try and have a level of versatility that puts pressure on you. And we're going to try and get to drive and kick and try and run different actions to enhance Brandon Miller and Colin Knipple and put them in different positions to have success, while also having freedom for whoever our guards are in the lineup to get downhill and play, whoever our wings are in the lineup to get downhill and play, whoever our bigs are to roll and kind of make plays, to make reads, to flash, to get dribble handoffs. So that's kind of what the Hornets are going to do. So I kind of am enjoying that they made the move to go ahead and say, hey, yes, this is our plan. We're doubling down on the portion that we feel like we can build on, and then we're going to find out what we need to add to that, as opposed to all of this is going to allow us to become the next part of what we want to do.
Okay. Oh, that makes sense. Like, I think for me, my immediate intrigue was, again, as we talked about on Friday, like, if you're trading LaMelo, you're going to have to nail this from a cultural standpoint. And also, like, that is just a unique skill set going out the door. So, like, you're not going to find another literal LaMelo, but you got to find a way to replicate some of what he does at the very least. And I think to the three-point shooting in particular, that's why I was immediately intrigued by adding not just Grayson Allen, but Royce O'Neal. Obviously, both of those guys are very good spot-up shooters, so if shots are created for them, they should be able to knock down those shots. What we also saw in Phoenix, as we talked about last season, Steve, as they got off to their start and had their run ultimately, was that there was a lot of empowerment with a lot of the role guys in Phoenix. Like, you are empowered to make decisions with the ball, to drive, to pass, to take shots. And with Grayson and Royce in particular, they both experimented more with taking threes off the bounce last year. Like, neither to the level of LaMelo, and so it's not going to be a one-to-one replacement. But if you were at all worried about, hey, where's the three-point shooting going to come from, I think this is a step in the right direction to replace some of that. When you have two guys that are willing to not only get them up, but to get them up against contest, to get them up in different contexts. And one of the things that I was looking up heading into the pod was what exactly the LaMelo versus Grayson plus Roy split looked like in terms of three-point shooting last season. So obviously it's two players compared to one, but I want to see what that part was going to look like. And so looking at the catch-and-shoot attempts from last year, LaMelo took 310, Grayson and Royce took 615, so both averaging around 300 if you want to split that. LaMelo shot about 37% on catch and shoot threes. Grayson and Royce combined was at 40.3. You take that. LaMelo took 393 threes off the bounce, which doing some filtering on second spectrum, that step backs, pull-ups, 36% on off the dribble threes for LaMelo, around 34% for Grayson and Royce. And what really surprised me as I was looking this up, Steve, looking at the average distance of these off the dribble threes, LaMelo at 27.5 feet, Royce plus Grayson Allen, 27.6. I watched Suns games. We talked about the Suns. Like, obviously, there was some audacity to some of these attempts. I did not have on my bingo card that on average they took longer off the dribble threes than LaMelo did last year. And so, again, that's not me arguing they are just going to be LaMelo off the bounce. But there are seeds of this to where you can at least see the vision from Charlotte's side that we can replicate at least some of the three-point stuff. And, again, we are spreading more usage to Coby White, to Colin Knipple, to Brandon Miller, to replace some of the overall creation from LaMelo. So those two moves in tandem, again, not a guarantee that it works, but the vision and the process to me seems sound. And being able to get not just an unprotected first out of this deal, but getting one far away, a 2033 first round pick. If we get to that point, we'll see what that pick looks like. But at a vacuum, if you're talking about future trade deals involving the Hornets, if you get to 2028 or something like that, that 33 pick is still going to be juicy for some teams. Like, hey, this is far out enough to where this has some real value. So Charlotte still has a level of versatility and maneuverability with what they want to do. So I like the trade from their perspective. I am fascinated. Did you have more Charlotte thoughts you wanted to add? Nope. Okay, fair enough. I'll just say quickly on the Suns portion, like, I think for them, one, to the pick portion, because, like, there is the protection of the 29 first, but getting that 29 first in the room does unlock some maneuverability with their first round picks from 2027 to 2029. And so if there are other setup moves for the Phoenix Suns, that is more available to the actual player being acquired. I think it is just a bet on athleticism at the four and adding some juice to the transition attack. And so I get where that bet comes from, at the very least, from the basketball side. Also just feel for, like, my son's mutuals who are not pleased with the trade based on some of the clouds and some of the off-court allegations and things attached to Miles. So that is all I have on that front, honestly. Couple of the trades that have come through the pipeline before we get into some of the rumors that are hitting as we are on the cusp of free agency officially beginning. The Hawks and the Kings agreeing to a trade. Devin Carter and a future second going to Atlanta. The Sacramento Kings getting a 2033 second round pick, but that move gets them out of the second apron, and the Kings seem to be setting up for some moves that we'll get to in a little bit. And then over the weekend, the Detroit Pistons and the Oklahoma City Thunder agreeing to a deal. Isaiah Joe going to the Detroit Pistons, 2 second-round picks going to the Oklahoma City Thunder. We already knew heading into the offseason that the Thunder were going to have to trade, get rid of some players with their salary situation to help unlock bringing back an Isaiah Hartenstein, which they did. The team option with Lu Dort, which they have exercised. So we'll see if Lu Dort remains a member of the team, but at the very least, he is on the roster right now. But the Pistons getting Isaiah Joe in the room is interesting. One of the best shooters that we have in the league. Really good screener as well, I would imagine. Cade Cunningham is going to be very pleased with having Isaiah Joe in the building. So that is another deal that came through. Steve, are you ready to talk some NBA rumors?
Yeah, man. Let's have a blast.
Okay. So we start with this one. Rumblings, some wish casting, maybe, with the Golden State Warriors looking to add both LeBron James and Anthony Davis this offseason. Draymond Green opting out of his player option to create a little bit more flexibility for the Warriors to explore this. Now, we did get the reporting yesterday that Kristaps Porzingis agreed to a 2-year extension. And so that complicates things, but it doesn't, in a literal sense, rule out a pursuit, depending on other moves that would feature a Jimmy Butler being traded, though there's been assurances that they don't want to do that. But, like, there are pathways to pull this off. So I'll just ask you blankly, how would you feel if the Warriors were actually able to pull this off? Like, where would you stack them in the Western Conference if they had an actual big four of Steph Curry, LeBron, Anthony Davis, and Draymond Green?
So when I saw that, I was very intrigued because I understand everyone may be looking at the Western Conference with what Oklahoma City has, with what the Spurs just did, with the ability for Denver to reload Minnesota. Like, you have to deal with different things. LeBron, Steph look at each other and say, hey, you know what? Let's go one more round. Let's get this done. Let's swing for the fences. And as someone who's trying to appreciate the end or the potential end of, like, we're closer to the end for Steph Curry and LeBron James than we probably have ever been, to a degree, whether we know it or not. And so if they were able to combine forces, I feel like that'd be different. The Anthony Davis portion of it feels like, let me help my friend out real quick. I'm not going to lie. If I could be respectfully messy, let's
understood.
Let's make sure you're good as well. But the LeBron to the Warriors portion, I am extremely intrigued, because think about what he did last year in all sorts of forms, not just the quote unquote third option, et cetera, et cetera. It was, hey, I can still get these buckets. I can still put pressure on teams. I can still move the ball. If he was within the Warriors context, that's Steph Curry, I think that's a whole different dynamic. The Porzingis thing kind of made me think, I don't know how much this Anthony Davis thing is going to be for real. Mm-hmm. But if you're telling me I get to watch LeBron and Steph and Draymond try and make a swing out of this from an IQ perspective in the Western Conference, I think that'd be very fascinating. Now, we are doing some reckless speculating, because who knows what's going to happen. But my eyebrows are raised. I'm very intrigued. We know about things for a reason, so we'll find out.
I think for me, this would just be a lot of fun to see. Like, my immediate thought was, hey, post blitz with LeBron James, and you have Draymond screening for Stephen Curry. And if that doesn't work, now you still have to worry about Anthony Davis on the other side of the floor, dive again late, and you're finishing in, like, the defensive front line of Anthony Davis and Draymond Green, where, like, neither one of them really wants to play five, but both of them can play five, and, like, the other can roam if the guy's playing five. Like, it is fun to think about. I would still have some very obvious questions tied to that, because to pull this off, like, you are just kind of, you're making a bunch of moves, you're gutting your depth, you have to rebuild that, and then there's just the general age / health concerns with that. But that is a lot of fun to think through. So I don't know if it happens. If you're asking me as of June 30th, 8:49 a.m., if it's going to happen, I'll probably say no, especially in light of the Kristaps thing. But, oh boy, I feel like that is a play now online, like, top three team for folks, just picking the Warriors and just bullying people with, like, point LeBron and Steph at the two and just making people upset. So, like, that is a fun thing to talk through. I don't know how realistic it's going to be. The Draymond opting out piece made it feel a lot more real, though. So we'll see what happens on that front. While we're here and talking about potential superstar trades, Kawhi Leonard potentially back to the Toronto Raptors all these years later. I think clearly wants an extension. The Clippers have some questions about giving the extension, or at least as long of one as Kawhi and the camp may want. And thus, all the reporting suggests the only team that he would be willing to sign an extension with, if it's not the Clippers, is the Toronto Raptors, the team that he won a championship with and notably did not return and went to the Los Angeles Clippers after that. So, Steve, where are you at with Kawhi Leonard potentially going back to Toronto?
Well, I mean, it's almost July. I always spin the block. I'm intrigued to see exactly what's going to happen here. And I think the only thing that we found out, Nikias, is that Kawhi Leonard probably is not going to be a Clipper next year. So I'm intrigued to see how that works out. The Toronto portion, if he wants to stay there, like, is that the swing you want to make if you're Toronto? What's the right price? Do you want to do this now? Like, because I think if you're able to get Kawhi, you keep Scotty Barnes, you're able to keep Colin Murray-Boyles. Like, I think based on what Toronto has done the last couple of years, being able to add the bucket getting of Kawhi, maybe insulating him throughout the season to keep him healthy, that could become a force in the playoffs, because we saw them kind of knock around the door. Just didn't necessarily have the super punch. And so if you add Kawhi, we've already seen him do it in Toronto, do you now open up a different window in an Eastern where there's an area of opportunity? Mm-hmm. And so can you kind of climb up another brass ring with Kawhi Leonard and continue to add to what you've done? I think that's intriguing. The Dallas portion did make me raise my eyebrow. Mm-hmm. Just as far as I had not considered that. I did not that would be something. I was like, I was not considering that they could just turn things and just have Kawhi and Cooper Flagg and Kyrie. And hey, it's a new era in Dallas. Like, I'm just like, that would be fast tracking the timeline to a degree, but I could understand fast tracking it if you can get Kawhi Leonard. So I get that one. I think the funniest thing is the immediate no's to teams as they were brought up. It's like, yeah, Detroit. Nah, I'm not doing that. Nah, I'm not going to do that. So. Which also, I know we're going to get Detroit in a little bit, but interesting offseason of reporting for the Detroit Pistons. But I think Kawhi in Toronto would be fun for most. There are some who may not enjoy the fact that he wants to stay now as opposed to when he was there before. But hey, it is what it is.
Well, let me tell you, Steve, I know quite a few people that are mildly annoyed at Kawhi either earnestly spinning the block in this case or using the Raptors as leverage to get the contract that he wants from the Los Angeles Clippers. And either way, I can see why that would provide some angst for the fan base. But if you're just, you know, just stripping it all away, Kawhi Leonard is coming off of, if not the best season of his career, at the very least, the best offensive season of his career. So obviously he is still a very high level player when healthy. And while this year's Raptors, or this version of the Raptors, they don't have a Kyle Lowry to keep things afloat, Scotty Barnes is very, very, very good. And if you have this infrastructure of elite defense, fine enough offense, if we're talking about the games that Kawhi doesn't play, and then when he is on the floor, Kawhi, you are our number one scoring option. Scotty Barnes can do everything else. And then you get to a playoff setting to where you get Kawhi Leonard. And if we get any semblance of what we saw from Scotty Barnes in the playoffs last year, where he is super aggressive while also doing the defense things, that is a terrifying concept to have those two on the floor together. And so also from the Raptors perspective, if the price is Brandon Ingram plus other stuff versus we got to give up Scotty or we got to give up CMB and a bunch of picks, if we're starting the bidding at Brandon Ingram, who was very good but was not healthy during the postseason, yeah, I probably do that. Even if I don't want to accelerate things, I absolutely do that. I will say, to your Dallas point, that is absolutely a spend the block from Masai Ujiri. Like, hey, that guy's really good also. We did some good things together. So I do respect that portion of the program. And similar to the price point with Toronto, like, if the Kawhi package is going to be headlined by PJ Washington, who is a very good player, but writing's kind of already on the wall about him being a trade candidate, include a Daniel Gafford, who's also a quality backup big or a quality starter big, but writing's been on the wall about his availability. If we're using those two pieces and they were probably going to be out the door anyway to balance the roster, you could turn that into Kawhi. I almost don't care if there isn't a long-term commitment. You just get a ridiculous talent add to play alongside Cooper Flagg and you get Kyrie Irving back. It just feels like a low-cost deal. And if he's not going to be back, we could just work some sign-and-trade stuff next offseason and kind of replenish the room that way. So I understand that from the Dallas perspective, in addition to, hey, Masai Ujiri wants to spend the block. So that part is intriguing. While we're on wing, Steve, Jaylen Brown does not seem to be pleased. There are a lot of conversations tied to, one, him just being up for Giannis but ultimately not being traded. The Portland stuff, we don't know where that's going to go. Charlotte's been loosely linked, but we don't know where that's going to go. We now have round 847 of analytics versus eye test with Jaylen Brown at the top of it's just been a very odd offseason for Jaylen Brown, considering the season that he is coming off of. Do you think he's going to be traded? I guess that would be my free throw to you. You can also add a team if you would like, but do you think that he's going to be traded or is he going to be back in Boston?
I am uncertain at this point. I think the last podcast, it was fresh off, okay, Jaylen Brown's name came late in the Giannis race. Okay, someone's trying to do something. I get it. And it has not stopped ever since then. And so I don't know what's happening here. Like, I never thought this was really a possibility. I thought he did so many good things to get Boston in a great position for Jason Tatum to come back and push themselves. And for that to just become this chorus of whatever this is, I'm a little confused. I don't get it to a degree. And so it's like, I feel like, no, Jaylen Brown's not going to be traded, but I feel like the noise just continues to swell until it's just going to happen. Like, I'm uncertain there. What do you, like, I'm looking at, like, Jaylen Brown Denver Nuggets rumors. I'm like, how did we collectively end up here? Like, and then you have teams like, no, we don't want Jaylen Brown. Like, did you have an option to get Jaylen Brown?
Who asked?
It's like, who was this on the table for you? You just jumping out the gym like, nah, we're good. You were good before you said you're good.
Like, what are you, anybody come to see you, Otis? But no, it's very odd that it has turned into all of this. And I'll just quickly say, because it seems like, I don't want to overplay and say like a ton of smoke, but I have heard more about and have read more about Jaylen Brown Denver Nugget than I ever anticipated. And I will just say, conceptually, while Jaylen Brown is very good, for a Denver team that already doesn't take a bunch of threes, I don't know if I love swapping out Jamal Murray in a trade for Jaylen Brown. Even if you want to, like, if you want to argue Jaylen Brown is better, like, I'll hear you out at the very least. But, like, stylistically, it just feels like a very heavy, we're going to have a three-point rate of, like, 17. And I don't know how fair that is to Nikola Jokic and everyone else. Obviously, they have an offseason to reconfigure their roster. I don't love that fit. just in a vacuum. But we'll see. If you talk to me Friday, I'll probably be like, hey, they just got to mend the relationship. We're going to be okay. It does just kind of feel like this is trending towards Jaylen Brown being traded at some point this offseason. And I just kind of have to wrap my head around that happening, regardless of where it ends up being.
Can we just slow it down? Y'all got Robert Parrish mad. Like, come on. Can we?
Yeah,
can
we just figure this
thing out? Like Robert Parrish is upset by this. Why is it disturbing? Can we figure this out? Now, the other part of this is, is it safe space, Nikias?
Yeah.
Are all these rumors just like when people don't know how to use the saxophones or getting louder meme?
I'm so glad you said this because I am so tired of seeing that misused. I was like, one, why are you using this like that? Two, I guarantee you, Twitter user, do not even know where that came from. This is a societal complaint that we can't get into on this podcast. We might need to start the Dunker Patreon for it. Absolutely not. Anyway, while we're here, let's go to the other Jaylen, Steve, because on Friday, he's like, hey, some stuff popping with Jaylen Brown, some stuff popping with Jaylen Duren. What's happening here? Jaylen Duren, Sacramento King, ? Is that where this is heading? Set to meet with the Kings, set to meet with the Los Angeles Lakers. Apparently, the negotiations have gone to the point where he's like, not only am I having meetings, like, I want a signing trade out of here. Whether that is Sacramento, we'll see what happens with the Lakers, though I would imagine Luka Doncic would be very pleased if that ends up being the move. Is Jaylen Duren actually just out of Detroit? How do we get from Detroit could be a player for Kawhi and we're going to add some shooting to the room into, we got Isaiah Joe. We don't know what's happened with Duncan Robinson yet. We don't know if Tobias Harris is coming back and Jaylen Duren is ready to leave. What is this speed run of Detroit rumors?
It feels like a sitcom plot to a degree. Prom-related, but you can make that jump on your own. I think the biggest thing here is, right, Jaylen Duren's like, hey, I would like to get compensated. Detroit's like, cool, don't worry, we got you. And Jaylen Duren like, cool, here's this amount. And Detroit's like, ha, I don't know about that, but we got you. And Jaylen Duren's like, well, I would like to be a Sacramento King. Detroit's like, well, you still are a restricted free agent, so I mean, that's cool, but we'll pay you this. And so I don't know who's trying to get leverage or what. The Kings, I mean, I would get the Kings trying to add a Jaylen Duren. Detroit, it gets interesting, right? Mm-hmm. There is a fork in the road to a degree in the sense that, okay, you did win 60 games last year. Are you going to now change your team to a degree? Like, I think you moved Isaiah Stewart with the feeling like we're going to keep Jaylen Duren. This is fantastic. If you now turn Jaylen Duren into Domantas Sabonis, what does that look like? What does that feel like? If you're the Sacramento Kings and you are now able to get Acuff and Jaylen Duren, what does that feel like? How much money is being printed in Sacramento based on how things are going? So I'm more just intrigued to see what the next step is. Like the Lakers knocking on the door, be like, hey, do you want to be a Laker? And I'm like, how would that work? I don't know. It's clear he wants to be compensated, and I understand that in this era. Let me get what I can get when I can get it. But do you want to overcorrect because you had a lot of success, not just because of your improvement, but because of the context in Detroit? Playing next Kate Cunningham is a benefit for you. Can they find a middle ground, I think, is the key for both Detroit and Jaylen Duren. But I didn't see the Kings coming to this. And I know Sabonis is probably like,
Yeah, I'll go. That's pretty neat.
I can do some dribble handoffs.
I will play with Cade Cunningham. Like, I think I can make that work. You know who's actually annoyed by these talks, Steve?
Who?
Maxine Raynaud. Because what do you mean I have this rookie campaign as one of, like, three bright spots in Sacramento last year? All rookie. And now you telling me here comes Jaylen Duren? We about the same age. He about to be making max money. What? Excuse me? But yeah, to your point, in all seriousness, it is kind of wild that we got here. And obviously, restricted free agency, there is just a level of – this is a level of leverage season to a degree. So, like, let's call Sacramento because I know they'll engage. Let's hit up the Lakers because I know they still have cap room. Like, the Austin Reeves max is coming. But because of how low the cap hold is, we can make moves and then sign Austin Reeves later if we order it the right way. So we can be a player in this. This could just be, hey, I have real suitors. You're going to have to pay up or you're going to have to match an offer sheet. Like, let's get this ball rolling. So we will see what happens on that front. But yeah, to your point, this has gone from we're bringing Jalen Duren back, we're trading Isaiah Stewart for a little bit more wiggle room this offseason, plus Paul Reed was good for us in the minutes that we got. And now it's like, wait, what if both of the centers are gone? And like, I'll also say, Domantas Sabonis in Detroit, the handoffs and the screen setting for Cade really intrigued me, and just the general screen setting overall intrigues me. But to go from that defensive identity to now we now have Domantas Sabonis at the five instead of Jalen Duren would be kind of odd. Not that it couldn't work, but it would be very odd to me. The last joke I wanted to make on this front, Steve, is this just episode two, season two of Running Point with the Jalen Duren contract stuff?
Yes.
Is that just what this is? Okay, yes. Fair enough. Fair enough.
Yes.
Okay.
Can I ask you one absurd question before we wrap this up with some sort of rapid fire, because so many things have happened?
Mm-hmm.
We're recording today. We can't predict the future. But who is hurt more today? Jalen Duren deciding he wants to leave the Pistons, or LeBron James immediately saying, I would like to leave the Lakers. I'm out of here. I'm going to Golden State. Who's hurt more today?
Oh, dear. Like, between those fan base. Like, I feel like it kind of has to be Detroit by default, because it's just like, how did we get here? Like, it has to be like a bit of a roller coaster of this guy has turned into an all-NBA talent into, well, that playoffs kind of stunk, but he is young, and that's his first one, into I want to go to Sacramento. And it's just like, well, hold on. This seems like a lot. What, like, the LeBron stuff, you obviously want him because he's still very good, and you want him to have his final year or final 2 years there. But there is just this inherent pressure of we do have to officially turn this over to Luka. And we are bringing all threes back, so we do kind of have to reconfigure this. It would stink to lose LeBron, but it does kind of push you into what was going to be a pivot point for you anyway. The Jalen Duren stuff is just odd. Like, I just don't think you had that on the bingo card. And because he restricted, you don't have to, but I'd say the Detroit section.
Okay.
The one thing I want to get to before we close things out, because we've had a lot of team options, player options. We can get to that stuff on Friday as free agency officially opens. We'll have a bunch to react to. We didn't really get to talk about the draft all too much, and so this is not going to be a draft deep dive, but more so some things that we liked from draft night, some winners and losers to kind of cap this off since we didn't get to do it on Friday. Steve, what did you enjoy from the draft? Who would be some of your immediate winners from the draft as we head
into I enjoyed a lot about the draft. I think the most fun part was the top four teams felt very good about the top four players they were going to get. And that's a rarity. Like, it's not something you always get in these drafts. So, I mean, if you're sitting around, you're Washington, and yeah, we get the incredibly high ceiling of AJ DeBonta. Like, we'll take his size, his skill, and his ability. And you're the Utah Jazz. Yeah, Darren Peterson fits right into our future. He's shifty. He can shoot. He slides right into what Will Hardy wants to do. And we can kind of embrace that offensively and kind of continue to grow. Yeah, we're the Memphis Grizzlies. We'll take Cam Boozer's versatility, skill, and decisiveness in passing. That's fantastic. That's no problem. And then the Chicago Bulls, okay, we have a young core. Let's add some athleticism. Let's build around Caleb Wilson. Let's mold him into a complete talent. The other ones that I liked, the Morris Johnson Jr. fit in Dallas, let him just run around and do things. Let him go ahead and be an absolute menace. I would like to watch him play defense. That's very fun for me. LeBron finally being a Sixer is fun. Ibaka Okori being a Piston is very fun. Like, let's double down and get buckets and drives. And yeah, let's go ahead and add to what worked. Yeah, Danish Jenkins, that's fantastic. Let's do that again. Is it going to work perfectly? No. But I would like to see it. And then the Spurs looking at those Luke Kornet minutes and saying, you know what?
Nope, let's get some athleticism.
We're going to have some bigs. Don't worry about it, big dog. You take your time, rest up. We got two bigs. You can do the defense, and then Terrace Reed, you can roll. We'll figure it out. Don't worry about it.
Big Terrace, not the little one. Very excited for him landing in San Antonio in particular. I'd say to bounce off of your top 4 point very quickly, very intrigued by what the Chicago Bulls were able to do. And to add not just Caleb Wilson, to add Dayla Swain on top of that, that is just a lot of size, athleticism, versatility added to the room that already has Matas Buzelis. And, like, I'm just really intrigued by what they're doing in the wing/forward room in Chicago. I just kind of like the direction that the Chicago Bulls are going again, Steve. Like, I am intrigued by how they are building this off. Like, I want to see how Tiago Splitter fits in Chicago as the new head coach. Like, I just kind of like what Chicago's doing. The Memphis Grizzlies, though. Cam Boozer, of the talented top three, or top four, really. But of that talented top four, like, Cam Boozer was my favorite of the group. Like, give me big fella that can post up and drive and run some pick and rolls, can pass. like there's just a versatility offensively to him that I think is, I can't say he's getting slept on because he went top three and he was in conversation for number one until very late in the process. So I don't want to overdo it, but I don't know if people understand like a guy that is just good at that many things already while also being like 19, like there is just a super high ceiling on top of all of this. So him going to Memphis in particular, hashtag draft good basketball players. We are back, baby. You get Kareem Lopez after some trade downs. You get Richie Saunders to get you some buckets in the second round. And I also love the bit of let's get some draft picks to slide down to 21 to get Kareem Lopez. And then let's also send those picks back to Detroit to get Isaiah Stewart essentially for free. And so now you have the center rotation of Zach Edey, if he's healthy, who's just been a plus-minus monster and in general just draws a lot of attention on the interior. You didn't go to Isaiah Stewart, who's one of the best interior defenders in basketball. You have Cam Booser, who could play off of either one of those dudes. Because of the John Morant trade, you have more wings and forwards in the room to where if you want to play Cam Booser at the five at all, you at least have the line of versatility to do that. This is where I'm just super high on the Memphis Grizzlies overall, Steve. So, like, that got me. The Oklahoma City Thunder, like, letting Mara fall to 12. And maybe fall is too aggressive, but what do you mean you now have Isaiah Hartenstein? If he goes to the bench, here comes big 7'3 dude that can lock down the interior and also can play make. That doesn't seem very fair for teams. So like that would got me. I'm trying to think, was there anyone else that I want to sprinkle in here on the draft winner board? I think that probably does it. Also, getting Bennett Sturgis, getting Otega Owe, I'm intrigued by both of those picks. Bennett Sturgis just knows how to play basketball, audacious shooter, very good playmaker, et cetera. Some good things happen during the draft this year. And so I think that's where I'll leave it. As far as draft losers go, I just want to say draft hats. That's what I want to add to the conversation. I understand why it happens the way that it does because some of these trades can't be finalized to the new league year and things like that. But like, if you know that a pick is being traded beforehand, like, why are we giving the draftees the hats of the teams that are trading them when you know they're not going to be there? Can we just get like a general NBA logo hat for those guys? At the very least, like, you still have a hat, but it's not the team. Is they're just not wrong? Like, can we figure out some kind of middle ground here on that front? Because I also just kind of laughed at the second round where, like, literally every pick except for the Raptors pick was traded in some capacity in the second round. So that one got me. Those will be my quick draft losers. Did you have any draft losers, Steve, before we take a break?
Just the people that were anticipating a lot of trades for, like, people. Players, veterans. No, this is deep draft, and we feel pretty comfortable with what we have, and we could move up, but if not, we're fine. We'll just make a selection. It's cool.
We get in seconds.
It's all good. So no worries there. So yeah, you know what I mean. You never know. The hats thing, it's fine. Because here's the thing: one day they're gonna switch it, and the trade's gonna fall through, and then what? Then what y'all gonna do?
Well, this is why you go NBA logo hat because he's entering the league. But, you know, and then, you know, you have your general team interviews and introductions and all the good stuff. You'll have the hat and the jersey. So, again, I think there's a middle ground that can be found there. I just don't like, hey, let's give this guy a heat. Why are we giving Nate Avent a heat hat when you know he's going to be like, we ain't got to do that. We ain't got to do that. It's just kind of odd to document it that way. But I'm off my soapbox. We're going to take a break. And when we return, Steve, we shift to the W Commissioner's Cup Championship game later today. And boy, are the middle of the WNBA standings a tight mess. We're going to talk through it all. We're going to have some fun. Please stay tuned. We are back with this episode of the Dunker Spot as we shift to the W, Steve. As always, we're coming off of a fantastic weekend of basketball. We had a quadruple overtime game over the weekend. It's a pretty big matchup heading into the league. What are you most excited about as we head into the week?
Well, Nikias, sitting here, Commissioner's Cup will end here shortly. We'll talk about that later. We have talked about our tiers, and we've got some questions about the middle. I do want to take a second to talk about the top of the league right now, and specifically the Minnesota Lynx and what they've done. Mm-hmm. I think sometimes here in the Dunker Spot, it's kind of easy for us to stamp a team as very good and then just kind of keep it moving because they stay very good. But do we realize how good the Minnesota Lynx are right now? Like, my brain still goes back to the preseason. I don't know if you remember. The Lynx played, I think it was like the Tempo, and Cheryl Reeves was just flat out not happy with the starting lineup. And the funniest part of the Minnesota Lynx being very good is like the like quarter interviews where they interview Cheryl Reeves, and it's like, well, you know, we did some good things, but we got a lot to clean up. And then they just clean it up, and they're good. 15-4 on the season, 9-1 on the road. They've won 13 of their last 15 games, Nikias. Since May 21st, they're 13 two. And I think what stands out to me quickly is like the foundation and the growth of this team stands out. We saw this Lynx team have a run over the last 2 years, established themselves at the top, didn't get the title, watched a whole lot of roster leave, and hey, Nafisa Collier is injured. And that team that they had a firm identity on both ends of the floor. You had to deal with Fee, you had to deal with Court, you had to deal with Caleb McBride. But there was a level of ball movement that they're going to deliver. And once we get you in rotation, we are a machine. Good luck scoring on us. We're flying around defensively. You fast forward to this year, Nikias. We may not have the same identical firm identity, but Olivia Miles here, the keys to the car, some gas money, and some pick and rolls. Let's see where we go. And boy, did we. And it's not just the scoring and the passing from Olivia Miles. It's the continued poise and patience that's on display. I said early on this season, okay, let's see what this looks like against like teams that want to mix coverages. Are we able to do that? It hasn't been a problem. Teams have tried that. Hasn't mattered as much. Natasha Howard rolls. If you don't show, whether it's a Natasha Howard screen, a Court screen, a Caleb McBride screen, Olivia Miles turns, drives, and kick. And what you've now seen is a Lynx team that understand, oh, that's right. We can get teams in rotation. Mm-hmm. You look at the freedom that Caleb McBride and Courtney Williams are playing with. Not that they don't have never played free, but, oh, we don't have to do that part as much anymore. Yeah, Rook, turn that corner.
You got it?
We're going to go ahead and make our plays outside of it. And they're now becoming a machine again on that end. Defensively, it might not be the same exact results. It may not be the same, I would say, but the results aren't much different. And so I know some folks don't respect the box score, but good luck scoring 80 points against the Lynx. You're averaging about 79. They got a plus 11 point differential because they average 90. So I wanted to give a tip of the cap to the Lynx there. Did you have any Lynx thoughts here?
Oh, no. I'm right there with you in terms of them just kind of being machine-like on both ends, and the ways that they have shifted offensively has been fascinating. As you mentioned, Olivia Miles has more of the keys. It's very funny that the Lynx were an elite offense last year, and they were towards the top of the leaderboard in assist rate because of the ball movement. You can move feet around the board. They just create advantages go here. The Minnesota Lynx, third in offensive rating. They were first about a week and a half ago, so like they're not that far off. They are dead last in assist rate, Steve. And to your point, like Natasha Howard, if you switch against us, we're just going to beat you up on the interior. If you just give a traditional coverage, Olivia Miles can just get downhill. They are deadly in transition as a team overall. And so like the fact that it doesn't have to be the beautiful game for them to have a good offense, they can just bucket get against you. In addition to the principles that they do have baked in with the off-ball movement and the general ball movement, they can tap that button too. It's kind of crazy they can hit both sides of the coin. The defenses are having fun. And to your point, no Nafisa Collier. Not only do they have the best defensive rating in basketball, they are the only team in the W with a defensive rating under 100. They are nearly 5 points better than second place. Olivia Miles has done her job. Courtney Williams has done her job. Caleb McBride has been very good. Both Nia Coffey and Natasha Howard have legitimate all-defense cases this year. They have been fantastic. So I'm right there with you. We have talked about how good the Lynx are and gotten to some particulars. We can't get bored with greatness. The Lynx deserve more love for what they are doing this year. So I appreciate you bringing them up.
Oh, nice. Fantastic. I'm glad we talked about the Lynx because I wanted to go ahead and break something else down here on this episode. And we did our tiers list. We kind of had our different agreements. The Dunkers gave us some responses on how they felt about the tiers. I wanted to check in on the middle of the WNBA because, Nikias, we're turning the corner towards where playoff positioning is something you can start to feel and starting to feel key. And your path now becomes more interesting. So while we shout out the Lynx, we talked about the Aces on the last podcast. We have some teams 3 through 7. As good as we felt about these teams, they are in a position to now fight each other. And whatever team ends up falling short, you get the Lynx or the Aces. So I wanted to check in and see how do we feel about that. I was inspired by the Dunkers. Shout out to Ash, because I was asked, the Golden State Valkyries, I had them in tier one. We got some disagreements about that. Got yelled at about it on the internet. And then they went ahead and beat the Dream twice, then beat the Liberty. And the question was, what did we learn about the Golden State Valkyries? And I was like, I'm not certain what we learned, because they can defend and drive and make threes. And when they do, they win. And when they don't, they don't. So where are you at with a team like Golden State, who has these question marks, but they have won 7 of their last 10 games? Sure, they've lost 5 games since May 28th. 3 of those were to the Aces and 2 of them were to the Lynx. They've literally just lost to the top 2 teams. So where are we at with them?
I think that's what complicates the conversation. Because I think if you have concerns about the Valkyries, I think it's more so going to be on the offensive end. And the general question is, can they score enough against the best teams in the league? And so when you play the Minnesota Lynx, who have the best defense in basketball, and as we just mentioned, they just had the best overall record, and you lose to them, and it's like, well, darn, we didn't beat the top. And while the Aces certainly haven't been that defensively this year, at least not consistently, this is the team that just won the championship. So naturally, you want to measure yourself against the team that just did it. And if you lose to them too, then it's like, well, darn, there seems to be a hard ceiling. The fact that the Valkyries can beat everybody else also speaks to how good they are. And even looking at the Aces matchups, or honestly, the Lynx matchups too, it's not like they just blew the Valkyries out the water in all of their matchups. You know, like Aces Valkyries went down to the wire, at least the first matchup did. And so they can compete with anyone because they have this strong defensive infrastructure. For me, it's more so figuring out, like, I have my broad strokes offensive questions. Like, what are they doing in the half court? What is it going to look like, et cetera? Seeing how that evolves and what lineups they lean into is kind of where I've been trying to dig a little bit deeper on the Valkyries front. Like, okay, to the half court portion, how often are we just getting Janelle Solange kind of like your nominal five now to maximize the spacing, to thus maximize the drives and thus get to the free throw line a little bit more? Like, watching those dream games in particular late, like Gabby Williams is losing her mind in the fourth quarter, that second one, it's like, okay, they do have players that can win one-on-ones. And while that may not be as, you know, as sustainable as I would like for it to be to just dub them as like a top tier offense, it does just kind of reinforce their formula to where we can just bring you into the mud. We can get you late in the clock. We can bring this game to our style. And then late, Veronica Burton can win a drive. Gabby Williams can win a drive. Janelle Solange can shoot over you. Zana Lassini can shoot over you. And like, we can just get enough and we can win these games. And so to your question, like, did we learn anything new? Like, maybe not with the 10,000 foot view, but this is just another example of when we hit our formula, to your point, when we hit our formula, we can play with and beat just about anyone.
I'm glad you brought up the dream, because their West Coast road trip turned into a little bit of an American nightmare as they went to Golden State, lost two, where, hey, we really can't score. Our defense is good. We're in a battle. And then you go to Seattle and, oh boy, let's introduce ourselves, Don Malanga, Awafam, and Flage Johnson. Let's have a ball. They give up 105. How do we feel about a dream team who has done a lot of good things, I think, this year, as far as to address what they were missing last year? Mm-hmm. Hot starts to a degree. The offense maybe has not hit a certain level, but you've shown we can win different ways. We have a high level of defense. Is this something that will pay off for them down the line? Or is this just kind of who they are right now? What's your thought?
I think it's more of the former than the latter. I think if nothing else, especially with the Seattle game, which I'll quickly note, no Nas Hillman in that game. They start Medina Okot at the five. As Cross Mesko talked about a little bit pregame, like, we haven't seen a ton of minutes with him, with her and Angel on the floor together offensively. And the start of that game was, let's try to hit Medina on these deep seals. Not the same flow offensively. And then on the other end, what if Awafam just knocks down every three she takes? So it's just an immediate like 8-0 run. It's like, oh boy, that seems less than ideal, trying to navigate that together. But I do think it's more of the former. Like, the defense has been very good all year long. They have now slipped to fifth in defensive rating in light of what that Seattle game was for them. But the defense has been pretty strong all year long. Offensively, they have found different ways to win. They found different ways to create shots. And I still, you know, this is an older end of the season dunker spot take for me. But you do kind of feel in some of these matchups, particularly the Valkyries game, it would be nice if they could just dunk the ball down to Bree Jones sometimes, just to kind of settle them in the half court at times. And so I did feel that sometimes in those Valkyrie matchups, because it then turned into, well, Ryan, do you have it? She did not against the Golden State Valkyries across both of those matchups. Alicia Gray, do you have it? Really good in transition. Sometimes I have it in the half court, but not consistently enough. Jordan Canada, do you have it in that first Valkyries matchup? Absolutely not. In that second matchup, nobody could guard her. And so, like, just having someone in the half court that can consistently say, I will get us a good shot, either for myself or for others, that would be helpful. And so I did miss Bree Jones in that matchup, but I feel like I've said that already. Like, the fact that they are still fourth in offense without Bree, they are fifth in defense after the late slide. They've been higher than that before that. There is just a foundation here that I trust and appreciate. And I think once you add Bree Jones into the mix, and I think you kind of settle in on what you want your overall rotation to be, I don't think I have major concerns about the Atlanta Dream right now. Now, as the sample grows, if I have more half-court questions, you know, we'll talk about those. But as of right now, I think they are doing a really good job in light of what the rotation and things is right now.
Understood. Now we go to the New York highest, and I will start with a rhetorical question that I will answer.
Okay.
Can the New York Liberty learn the lessons from last year? Let's take a step back. Let's take a timeout. Let's think about this. Last year, they started 11-3, if I remember correctly. They lost 3 out of 4 games to get to 12-6. They rolled off 5 straight wins, and then things turned south and never fully recovered, right? Mm-hmm. This year, the New York Liberty start 11-4. They have lost 4 of their last 5 games, and they are now 12-8. And now we are at a similar position, and so I will say, how can you avoid it feeling like last year? They have shown once again what the peak is, what the formula can be. They've gotten good contributions up and down the roster at times. Injuries have dinged the consistency lineup-wise once again. You do have more depth, in theory, to handle it. But you now arrive at a point where who has it going? What's our best combinations? You are back in the scenario where, okay, we're having a really good defensive night. Oh, no, we can't score. Hey, we're scoring the basketball. Oh, no, we can't guard. Sounds familiar, right? Satu finally, and I mean truly, turns a corner. And then Satu is out of the lineup. Marine had it going. And then you bring Marine off the bench. And is it the same Marine that we had for most of the year? Sabrina's back. But is Sabrina back?
Not yet.
Soul searching. Now keep in mind, of this 4 out of 5 game stretch, the one win was in Las Vegas, which is just the most New York Liberty thing they could do of all time. So where are you at with the Liberty at this specific point in the season?
I think for me, it is very much, I'm just gauging the lineup stuff more than anything, because I'm right there with you. It has felt like they haven't been able to put together the full package consistently during this run, where you can see them get up and down. You get the three-point shooting, you get the transition steals, because they have so much size up and down the lineup. But it's like, okay, can y'all, what exactly are y'all doing off the ball defensively more than anything? You also have to contain drives better than they have been during the stretch, which is also like, hey, man, if someone's setting a pin in or so, y'all just have to communicate some of this. Like, you should not be getting blasted on some of these off-ball actions the way that you are with the talent and the IQ that you have in the room. And so, like, some of – and this is where it's always kind of tough for me to gauge with basketball teams in general. When I know there is talent there and you are having these specific types of mistakes, particularly defensively, it's just like, I can't really point to coaching with this. Y'all just kind of have to do y'all jobs. And if you do your jobs, you're going to be fine. If you don't, then you're going to keep running to the same issue. I do think to the overall lineup point and trying to figure out when is everyone coming in, when are they flowing together. I think that's the most pressing thing for me, just trying to figure out what the combinations are, you know, to bounce off of what you said there, Steve. Because I think you want to have at least 2 of the guards going. Like, ideally, you have everyone going at the same time, but it's basketball, that's not realistic. Like, them trying to figure out between Marine, Pauline, and Sabrina, like, who's actually going to get us into our stuff and also maintain the level of aggression has just been kind of wonky to watch. Because it feels like Sabrina is very much trying to lean into, let me get everyone set up and I'll find my spots. And she hasn't really been able to pick out the latter portion consistently. Marine will get hers, but it's like, okay, how consistently are you setting up things? And then what is the defense? And Pauline, like, I'm going to drive all over the place, but like, what is the setup piece and what is the defense? It's been an interesting mismatch for me. And so, again, similar to the tiers conversation, like, I'm not pressing the big red button yet. I am letting this sample grow before I, like, actually get into, hey, not only do I see these concerns, this doesn't seem to be getting better. And, like, what are y'all going to do about it now? Right now, it's just very much they're trying to figure things out. And, like, to your point, Satu being out of the lineup again, it does free up more minutes for some of the three-guard looks and things, so you have more of a chance for those players to gather some rhythm. But they do need to solve, like, what their top 9 is going to be and what it's going to be consistently at some point.
Understood. Very good. So we're back at last year. Well, we're not back at last year because I have a question about the Dallas Wings. What do we do with the Dallas Wings at this point? Because I think we had a lot of question marks early on, a lot of controversy, a lot of noise. Things changed. They had an upswing, but they're sitting at 11-8, right? Mm-hmm. And if you look at what's happened, they have lost to the Dream twice. They have lost to the Lynx 3 times. They beat the Aces. They beat the Liberty. They beat the Aces. Then they lost to the Aces. They lost to the Valkyries. Are they the team that is slightly below these teams as far as we are working to get to a higher ceiling, but we're not quite there yet to beat all of these tier one, 1.5 type teams. Is this just part of natural evolution? Or is this a team that, hey, we have a high octane offense until we don't, and our defense, when it's good, we're in a good shape, and then when it's not good, we're in danger. Where are you at with the Wings?
I would say I'm probably closer to the former. I will just quickly say, like half jokingly, but I did look up some numbers for it. The Dallas Wings being super competitive and beating all these top tier teams, then they see the Minnesota Lynx. They're just like, nah, not us. It does just kind of crack me up. And it kind of led me to look up some of these defensive numbers in particular for the Dallas Wings. And so, per Second Spectrum, their half-court defensive rating against everyone not named the Minnesota Lynx, 0.9 points per possession, which would be one of the better marks in the league. Against the Minnesota Lynx in their matchups, over 1.1 points per possession on those trips. That is not going to get it done. Expected shot quality, which just factors in what types of shots being taken, how close is the defender to contesting, et cetera, et cetera. 49% effective field goal percentage or expected shot quality against everyone. That's very good for a defense. Against the Minnesota Lynx, that rises to 52.4. In pick and roll against literally everyone else, 0.9 points per possession allowed. Against the Minnesota Lynx, 1.07. That is not going to get it done. So, like, again, half jokingly, because I have like clip wings on the graphic for the people watching on YouTube, but it does kind of lean into your overall question, Steve, of like how consistently can they match the top tier teams in the league? Because I think they have, because of the way that they play and because of the way that they can invert things with Jessica Shepherd in particular, against smaller, switchier teams, they always have avenues to create something good. And because of the pace that they play at, they just keep this consistent level of pressure on teams. And I think that helps them set up their defense, which sometimes can be activity-based. Sometimes they can be very aggressive with their help because they want to keep Jessica Shepherd back. And obviously, you have when you have a lot career next to her, like she can ramp up her activity on the back line as well. But when they don't have easy thing to poke at, it does kind of put more of a magnifying glass on some of the limitations for them in the half court, where it's, okay, Paige, incredibly skilled, one of the best players in the league. How often do you pressure the rim? How often do you look for your own shot to force defenses to rotate? It's more inconsistent than you would want for someone who is just objectively a top 10 player at worst. AZ Fudd, incredible rookie season. Obviously can move her around the board. The self-creation chops have been pretty fun for me, especially some of the mid-range pull-ups. But is she someone you want taking 16, 17, 18 shots in the game? And if she is, does she want to do that right now within a half-court context? I'm not sure yet. It also puts the magnifying glass on Arike Ogunbowale, who I think process-wise has fit in nicely into what Dallas wants to do offensively. Frankly, just has not made enough shots, especially during this most recent stretch. And so now, even if she does the right things, if you're missing, you're just back in transition defense anyway. You can't get set. And now teams can kind of come with this wave against Dallas. And so that's where it's just like, what needs to shift first? And I guess I'll toss that question to you, Steve. Do you want to see the defense get a little bit more consistent to help the offense get easier looks? Or do you think the offense needs to kind of power this in a way so they can set their defense more?
Just have more belief in the defense. I think at times you are searching defensively and you're changing coverages, but sometimes you have to live with the results of what you have. And so if you're going to do the drop to a late switch and peel, live with that. If you're going to hard show, live with that. But when you mix and get dinged in both, especially against the top teams in this league, you put yourself in a tough spot. I think that stands out, especially when they play Minnesota. It's like, all right, cool. Olivia Miles, we're sitting on your spot. We're going to do a late switch. AZ's going to navigate, peel out. We're going to stay at home. Okay, you show that. And then it gets dinged. And now, well, we can't do that anymore. So we're going to do a hard show. Now they're doing rejects. Now they're going guard screen. So it's like you need to slow the wheel down if you're the Wings defensively. I think offensively, they're always going to give themselves a shot with how they want to play. But I think defensively, you need to find a trust as far as just picking, okay, if we just get dinged by this, we get dinged by this. But by trying to kind of play whack-a-mole, they put themselves in a tough spot.
Okay.
And that brings me to the ever-present Indiana Fever, who are always dangerous. But the question is, we've talked about them many times this year. Has anything shifted? We know what the offensive highs are for this team. We know what it looks like when their defense is at a certain level. Do you feel any better about their chances, especially considering when we talk about these teams, like there's not a ton of separation, but they're currently in the spot you don't want to be in, which is, hey, would you like to play the Lynx or the Aces?
Yeah, like I think for me, the encouraging piece for me is that the offense seems to be finding more rhythm. And like, as you already alluded to, from a talent perspective, you know what highs they can hit. But it does seem like they know what they want to get into at a higher level at the very least. Like, it does feel like Caitlin Clark has found a lot more comfort within the offense. They are flowing to some of the Aaliyah Boston secondary stuff quicker than they were earlier in the year. And I think her and Kelsey Mitchell, you're starting to see that chemistry. It's already been strong in the years prior, but you're starting to feel that a little bit more. And so for me, they do just have, the ceiling is obviously there, but it feels like the floor of the offense feels a lot better than where it was 2 weeks ago, where we're just like, okay, what exactly is happening right now with this group? It feels like they're playing two different offenses. Now it just feels more flow-based. So I do appreciate that portion. I'm still kind of waiting on the defense to hit the levels that it needs to, and I think some of that is just tied to the lineups that they're getting into at times. But also, and I guess this is a question that I'll toss to you, Steve, because you already alluded to, we know what the defense can be when it hits a certain level. Do you think they have like consistent top five defense in them? Because right now they're seventh in defensive rating and they're not that far off the top five in a literal sense. But like, do you feel like they can just ascend to a, maybe not elite, but do you think they can just firmly get to good and stay there?
I think they can get to good enough.
Okay.
Like, I don't know if they're going to be a night in, night out, because they're going to have certain lineups. Certain people are going to be put in action. It's going to be different every night. But I think they can have enough of a base where if we figure X, Y, and Z out, you're not going to have fun. And if our offense is going, we're going to give ourselves a margin for error. So I think they can get to good enough. If they're seven and it hasn't been fantastic the entire season, I think there's still room to improve. So I would say maybe, yes, slight lean. I don't know if they're going to be a juggernaut on that end at any point in time, but I think they can do enough for what they need to kind of just be really good. Now, very quickly, you are in undisclosed location in a place that you disclosed, which doesn't make any sense to me. For the Commissioner's Cup, Aces Liberty, did you have any questions? Did you have any thoughts? What do you got, Nikias?
Yeah, I'll just quickly say, like, you know where I'm at. You don't know where I'm staying. You know, you got to keep that level of, you know what I mean? But to the actual game, question number one for me, are we going to see Asia Wilson, who tweaked her ankle against the Chicago Sky over the weekend, came back, ran from the tunnel to a lot of cheers, but came back, finished the game, but you never know if the ankle swells the day after, whatever. Listed as questionable. I'll be heading to Aces shoot around after we finish recording, so I will have a firm answer. So sadly, I will not have that answer on this podcast episode, so we'll see. But that is question number one, because if Asia's not there, obviously so much changes for the Las Vegas Aces on both ends of the floor, as they have not had a good time when Asia's had to sit so far this year. Beyond that, though, if we're assuming a level of health, I think tied to the Liberty conversation, like which version of Sabrina Ionescu are we going to get, which version of Benaja Laney Hamilton are we going to get, because they are both trying to just find their rhythm as they've missed a bunch of time this year. And so, like, if they are peak versions of themselves, the Aces may not have a good time. The defense for Benaja and some of the tilted defense attacking that she can get into, some of the spot-up shooting is going to be important. She is one of the many wings that they will toss on Chelsea Gray to kind of limit her impact offensively. That will matter. Sabrina Ionescu, if she has the blend of drives and playmaking, the Aces are already trying to figure out how often do we want to switch against this group in light of the size advantage that New York has. If Sabrina is dinging everything else with pull-ups and timely drives, and then again making plays against more aggressive coverages, that becomes more difficult for the Aces defense. And on the Aces side, for me, again, will Asia be there? But they have the best offensive rating in basketball, and they've done so by being dead last in drives per game, and they only logged, I think, 23 drives against the Liberty in their matchup last week, and I just do not think that's going to be enough. And as I talked about on Friday, when Becky Hammon was referencing that game, said I felt like we were a little bit passive with some of the shots and with some of the drives. So, like, what kind of downhill juice will we see from the Aces on that front? And this is going to be the first time that we see Kennedy Carter against the New York Liberty since she missed that game last week. On one hand, the drives and the self-creation should be very important for the Aces. On the other hand, Kennedy Carter is a small guard who has not been the most consistent defensively, and this Liberty team will poke at you on and off the ball if you have any kind of off-ball lapses or if you're just smaller, because they can post you up. So I am just generally curious about what her effectiveness in this specific matchup will be. I feel like it can go either way. So those are just my base Aces Liberty thoughts. What intrigues you most about this game, good sir?
Well, I mean, Kennedy Carter answers your drive question to a degree. So Kennedy Carter can attack a lot of those guards in a different way. You can put more guard play on the court. You're going to make someone a Liberty guard. So the back and forth between these teams has always been, Can the Liberty size and length bother Jackie Young, number one, Chelsea Gray, number two, enough to bog the Aces offense down? They probably trust their bigs to be able to defend. And then, okay, can our guards find enough headway to win enough matchups? And then our bigs, Jonquel, Stewie, are able to do enough things. It's always kind of just been the formula. If the Liberty get that defense, they give themselves a chance to get into a back and forth with the Aces that is different. When the Aces are able to attack the Liberty guards and kind of put pressure on them to the lineup portion, okay, yeah, size and length is going to be the issue. But if we can get to some of the other defenders, we now put ourselves in a strong position. So Kennedy Carter, Jackie Young, and Chelsea Gray all play together at some point. That is now going to put some pressure on the Liberty. So that's always going to be the ebb and flow. Obviously, you want to see if Asia Wilson could play, hopefully all is well. But when Jackie Young is playing at a high level and Chelsea Gray is playing at a high level, the Aces are very good. When they play at a high level against this Liberty team, it opens a whole lot up. So I would probably point to that matchup. What's Stewie's aggression level? What's Jonquel's aggression level? Can they stay out of foul trouble? That's going to be the battle. So I think that's probably where we're at. We've seen this team, these two teams, we've seen these two teams face each other time and time again. We will see it one more time. The chapter will close in a game that absolutely positively counts and means everything.
I'm glad you said that, Steve. Two things to close it out for me. One, to your Jackie Young portion. 20 points, 5 rebounds, 7 assists over her last 12 games. 46% from 3 on high volume. 38% from 3 on threes after taking multiple dribbles. Like, the pull-ups are going to be very important for her. They have been very important for her during the stretch. And that's going to be a part of her putting pressure on these Liberty guards and just in general New York's defense. Secondly, as I say every year, this is a game that is important to the Commissioner's Cup Championship in light of the money being raised and very important causes tied to that. It is a game that does not count towards the regular season standings and things. And so for my award voters out there that have official ballots, this is not a game that counts. Please do not factor this into your award thoughts, because this is not a game that literally counts towards the standings. I say this every year, say it on the NBA side with the NBA Cup. I say it with the Commissioner's Cup. Let's just be cognizant, absorb what you see, enjoy the game, salute the causes. But it's not one of the 44. So just keep that in mind. That's all I have to say on that front. With that being said, man, Steve,
why are you always telling voters what to do, man? Let them live.
I'm trying to help. I feel like when I don't do this, we get 6 player of the year votes for players that aren't eligible and all kinds of other things. But either way, thank you for listening to and or watching this episode of the Dunker Spot. Please subscribe if you haven't already. We are on Apple, Spotify, RIP Google, Stitcher, Podbean, wherever you get your podcasts, you can find us. Subscribe to the Yahoo Sports main YouTube channel. That is where our W content will live. Subscribe to the Yahoo Sports NBA YouTube channel. That's where our NBA content will live as free agency is getting ready to ramp up. It's almost California Classic time, Steve. It's about summer league time. So we've got some rookie debuts happening over the next few days. It's going to be exciting, but you want to make sure you're locked in with us. You can follow me on socials at Nikias NBA. You can follow Steve on socials at Steve Jones 20. And with that, we will catch y'all later in the week.